Oh, hello, podcast people. This is Ann Altesh, your podcaster, your blogger. It's Sunday afternoon. It's very windy here in Wisconsin. I'm looking out my windows, seeing all the trees blowing around. It's quite dire, depressing. No, it's not really depressing. I want to start with an obituary for someone I'd never heard of, but I thought her story was interesting enough to get the blog started Sunday morning. I start with a quote from Timothy Leary. He said to her long ago, "You are looking for a way out of the decadent aristocratic game, the limbo of jet-set desperados. I'll show you the way." And that's quoted in her obituary in the New York Times. Joanna Harcourt Smith, lover of Timothy Leary, high priest of LSD, dies at 74, traumatized by her experience with the psychedelic Pied Piper. She spent decades composting her thoughts about him and learning to start her life over again. She came from a very rich family, so she was very rich when he met her. She was 26, and he was 52 and a fugitive from justice. He'd been sprung from prison where he was serving a 10-year term at that point. She was with him when he was recaptured in Afghanistan. And it's actually a little hard to understand. She was never charged with a crime, but she seemed to be helping him escape. But I guess maybe it wasn't in the United States, or maybe they were using her for something else. But here's a quote from Mr. Leary's archivist, Michael Horowitz. He said, "Neither the counterculture nor the prosecutors in prison system knew what to make of her. Her outspoken upper-class European manner put people off. She had an edge and knew how to get her way. Tim empowered her, and she in turn was tremendously loyal to him, dedicated to getting him out, whatever it took. Alienating many in the counterculture was the fallout from that." Close quote. So then he got out of prison in 1976, and as the two of them became federal informants, so they lost a lot of friends by the fact that they were informants for the federal government. That's how he got out of prison when he did. He didn't serve 10 years, and he also did the escape. The feds put them in the witness protection program because they had so many enemies, and they lived outside of Santa Fe under the aliases James and Nora Joyce, which is funny because here are famous people being given the fake names of other famous people, James Joyce and his wife Nora. And Allen Ginsberg called her a CIA sex provocateur. Another quote from the obituary, "They were both alcoholics and fought all the time before splitting up. Ms. Harcourt Smith moved to the Caribbean and I think she lived in a boat. Where did I see that? Moved to the Caribbean and lived on a sailboat for a few years. She stopped drinking and taking drugs in 1983 and settled in Santa Fe, where she began life anew. I felt like a child who grew up in the forest," she said. "I had to relearn everything. I had so much shame and guilt that I could barely write." So the great filmmaker Errol Morris has made a documentary about her, and it's going to be on Showtime later this month. And she herself wrote a memoir. Her memoir is called Tripping the Bardo with Timothy Leary, My Psychedelic Love Story. And one thing I like to do is read the one-star reviews at Amazon, but it doesn't have any one-star reviews, so I read the two-star reviews, and I give them to you here first. The author had a 7-week affair with Timothy Leary before he was imprisoned. Then she spent years awaiting his release, dreaming of a settled married life in the distant future. The author fills the pages with countless acid trips, cocaine lines, infinite bottles of champagne, and continual smoking of her Galois cigarettes as she awaits Leary's release. While she claims an aristocratic upbringing, her class privilege and snobbery get tiresome. A parade of sexual partners, many of which she uses to enable her drug use, begin to seem amoral and sleazy. That she cooperated to entrap Leary's lawyer in a drug bust to help get Leary released from jail adds to her tawdry tale. This is the first time I threw a new book in the dumpster. And here's the other review. The author's foreword thanks the many friends and editors who helped her finish this nonsense, and then proceeds to write a rambling tale of hedonism that would bore Errol Flynn. Where, for God's sakes, were all the editors blue delete this pencils? As I was born in 1945, saw the 60s from Southern California, and served 2 years in the Army Airborne, drafted, no heroics, and had met other people's money, Leary, on occasion, I bought and struggled through this book out of pure curiosity. I finished the book in an evening, hoping that the author would arrive at some sense of the bardo she expounded. All I learned was 20 years of AA sobriety often leaves the cucumber less a pickle and fit only for relish on a Costco Polish dog, since, unfortunately, discontinued. Should I go more deeply into this Buddhist term that she uses, bardo? I have a feeling it doesn't get any clearer in the book, but it's a state of existence between death and rebirth, varying in length according to a person's conduct in life and manner of or age at death. So you're in a transitional state between birth and life. Tripping the bardo with Timothy Leary. Was she in the bardo? Well, she's died now. Maybe she's in the bardo now. Ever think about that? She just died. Maybe she's in transition. You don't know. The next piece I put up was from Washington Post, an article called After Thousands of Trump Supporters Rally in D.C., Violence Erupts When Night Falls. I was very interested in the way the prose in this article kept using that device of having non-human abstractions or entities doing the action rather than people. So violence erupts, that kind of thing. I think there was a tendency not to want to say that it was the non-Trumpster side of it that was doing the violence. But let me read this passage and you'll see how that is kind of in the article. So, quote, when darkness fell, the counter-protesters triggered more mayhem as they harassed Trump's advocates, stealing red hats and flags and lighting them on fire. Scuffles continued into the night as the provocateurs overturned the tables of vendors who had been selling pro-Trump gear and set off dozens of fireworks, prompting the police to pepper spray them. At 8 p.m., violence broke out 5 blocks east of the White House between the president's supporters, who wielded batons, and his black-clad detractors, many of whom had participated in racial justice rallies throughout the summer. As the groups approached the same intersection, they charged each other, brawling for several minutes before police arrived and cleared the area. Almost none of Trump's backers wore masks. Among their ranks were white nationalists, conspiracy theorists, and far-right activists carrying signs demanding action that was already being taken. Count the legal votes. Trump had thrilled them when his motorcade appeared on Pennsylvania Avenue shortly after 10 a.m., prompting fans to scramble to the side of Freedom Plaza to catch a glimpse. Trump, pack your shit. You're illegitimate, counter-protesters yelled into their megaphones. A family of four on Capitol bike share bikes, the father with an American flag tied around his neck like a cape, were cut off by a line of counter-protesters as they tried to leave a tense scene outside the Supreme Court about 1 p.m. Get out of our city, a young woman in black yelled. You lost, losers, shouted a man. The father and his teenage son began to chant USA and raised their fists as police officers surrounded the family and pushed them out of the crowd. Close quote. So that was Washington, D.C. yesterday. The next post. Oh, another post about Obama's book. And this is from the book review by the New York Times regular reviewer, regular nonfiction book reviewer, Jennifer Szalai, S-Z-A-L-A-I. And the title of the book review is In a Promised Land, Barack Obama thinks and thinks some more over his first term. I thought that was funny. Thinks and thinks some more, like he's thinking too much. He's thinking it over, and he's overthinking it. Quote, this is from the critic. His almost zealous commitment to moderation rankled some progressives who had assumed that his soaring campaign rhetoric meant he was a visionary bent on overturning the status quo. Whenever he felt stuck, he fell back on empathy and process. They sound like incommensurate traits. One is inventive and literary. The other is bland and technocratic. But for Obama, who in this book demonstrates an almost compulsive tendency to imagine himself in the lives of others, whether it's Hillary Clinton, John McCain, or in one case, a Somali pirate, a sound process was born of necessity. Decisions that were made after taking into account a variety of perspectives reassured him that he wasn't blinkered by his own. And I said, this book is 700 pages long and only goes up to May 2011, which means it includes his roasting of Donald Trump at the White House Correspondents' Dinner on April 30th and the killing of Osama bin Laden the day after, but does not reach the 2016 election, his abdication of his own red line in Syria, the entrenchment of the surveillance state, and a discussion of drone strikes. But Szalai, the reviewer, assures us, this isn't to say that A Promised Land reads like a dodge. And I said, ironically, that reads like a dodge. The reviewer could be thinking that cutting off at May 2011 was a dodge, but the dodge was well shrouded in contemplative prose so that it doesn't read like a dodge. Was it a dodge to stop at May 2011? She says it doesn't read like a dodge, but she may nevertheless think that it is a dodge, but that he wrote it in such a way that you don't feel, he keeps you from feeling like it's a dodge. But I mean, he picked a strong cutoff point, quit while you're ahead, and years later we'll get the next volume and we'll find out. We'll find out what's there. If it cut off at May 2011, it also didn't have the 2012 election. It didn't have an awful lot of stuff. But it's 700 pages long. I've considered reading it or getting it and looking around in it and finding bloggable things in it. I'm not a fan of his writing. I read his Dreams from My Father, and I'm not a fan of that style of writing, as I think I've said repeatedly. And indeed, I didn't sit down and read the book. I listened to the audiobook while walking around, I believe. It was when I was living in Brooklyn. I remember walking around in Brooklyn Heights and that area and listening to Obama's voice. I was pretty excited about Obama at the time. I didn't think he was going to get the nomination. I thought he might. I remember having some hope that he would, because hope because I didn't like Hillary. But I looked at his book. I probably have it in my Kindle, the second book, The Audacity of Hope. But that's like reading speeches. It doesn't have a voice to it. So I don't know how personal this new book, A Promised Land, feels. I have a feeling that it isn't personal, except to the extent that it has this brooding quality where you see him overthinking things. I think that's the tip that the reviewer here is trying to give us. I mean, I could do it. If my readers were clamoring for me to do something with Obama's book, Maybe I would. Would I do that? Right now I'm reading a book about the Beatles. I like to read all manner of things in magazines and newspapers and do it every day. The idea of really reading a book, I do that some of the time, often with audiobooks, but blogging from a book is something that can be done. I did it very closely when I read Bob Dylan's Chronicles, but other than Bob Dylan's Chronicles, I don't think that's really my style. And the book is 700 pages, and I know it's boring. I know it's boring. Everyone knows it's boring. Next, we see an article that is in the New York Times, and the headline is "There Was No Knockout, So Democrats and GOP Regroup for Next Round Voters." For next round, voters delivered a convincing victory for Joseph R. Biden Jr., but a split decision for the two parties. Now they face perhaps the most up-for-grabs electoral map the country has seen in a generation. And I don't want to use this post to delve into whether it's really true that voters delivered a convincing victory for Joseph R. Biden. I mean, you'd have to convince me that it's convincing. I assume it's going to end up being a victory, but I don't think it's a convincing victory, and I think Trump will at least have the satisfaction of denying the sense that it was a convincing victory, however it ends up. Presumably, nothing can be done about the way the electoral votes will go to Biden, and he will win, and Trump will leave, I assume. But Trump will be going around continuing to say, we'll always say, that it was rigged and that it wasn't a fair and square win by Biden. And I think he'll keep fighting and want to try to come back and win the presidency back. Because what else would he do? Isn't that the number one thing he should do? Keep rallying, keep doing what he does well. Why wouldn't he? But that's not what this post is about. This post is about a specific subsection of the article that's kind of stuck in the middle, but I think is the most vivid part of the article, and maybe the New York Times decided to forefront some other stuff and make the title the way they did so that it didn't make this part that I find interesting so much the main thing. But I've made it the main thing. And I begin with a quote from Chuck Rocha, a longtime Democratic consultant, and he said, the Hispanic community is not so. So we know that Joe Biden did, or the Democrats did not do well in certain Hispanic districts, and that Republicans did very well with Hispanics, much better than they had before. And so something is changing in the way the parties appeal to Hispanic voters and also Asian voters. There's a little of that in here. But Chuck Rocha, the longtime Democratic consultant, said, in trying to explain this, the Hispanic community is not a get out the vote universe. We're a persuasion universe and should be treated like whites. And he also said, he also criticized Democrats who see black and brown people as the same. So now, what does that mean? I think I know exactly what that means, and I can put that in a little more brutal form. He's saying, to put it bluntly, that black people can be counted on to vote for Democrats if you can just get them to vote. That's why that puts them in the get out the vote universe. So to get the black vote, you just have to get them to vote, and then you have them. They're in the get out the vote universe. But Hispanic people are like white people. What does that mean to say? Hispanic people are like, they're like white people because they're in the quote unquote persuasion universe. Just getting them out to vote doesn't work. They can and did vote for Republicans. The House districts that the GOP flipped in this past election were in what the New York Times called the heavily Hispanic or Asian regions. I think they shouldn't call them Asian regions. They should call them Asian American regions or Hispanic American. What's wrong with the Democrats' persuasion to Hispanic Americans and Asian Americans? quote, defund police, open borders, socialism, it's killing us, said Representative Vicente Gonzalez, a Democrat from South Texas. The average white person, Mr. Gonzalez added, may associate socialism with Nordic countries, but to Asian and Hispanic migrants, it recalls despotic left-wing regimes. Representative Harley Ruda of California, an Orange County Democrat who narrowly lost his bid for re-election, said he suffered with centrist voters and his district's numerous Vietnamese-American voters, many of whom recoil from the rhetoric of socialism. So socialism works particularly badly with this group because they associate it with their or their ancestors' homeland, and they don't have this European-like view of it. But so the socialism talk doesn't work on them, we're told. Well, this next blog post is, it's my art post of the day. I find I'm doing a lot of art posts lately. And this is about Nick Cave. Now, there's a musician, a songwriter, Nick Cave, and it's a different Nick Cave. There are two people. It took me a while to figure this out. But there are two people named Nick Cave. And the Nick Cave I'm talking about here is the artist. And I'm reading in the New York Times, Nick Cave's Truth May Be Writ. Nick Cave's truth, in other words, the word truth, Nick Cave's truth may be writ large, but is it a sign? The village of Kinderhook, New York, is not thrilled with the mark this artist made on a gallery. So the municipal government is demanding that it come down. So this artist put black vinyl letters, 20 feet high vinyl letters, the phrase, truth be told. So it's 21 feet high, each letter is 21 feet high, and the whole phrase goes 160 feet across the facade of a red brick building that is something called the school, which is not a school, but a branch of Manhattan's Jack Shainman Gallery. And the artwork is, we're told, intended to start a conversation about the death of George Floyd. Truth be told, so that was supposed to have to do with George Floyd, and I guess he thought people would somehow, truth be told, would move people to do something, say something in a conversation about George Floyd, but the conversation in that place, that town of Kinderhook, ends up being about whether the work is a sign or not, because if it's a sign, it's a violation of law and it needs to come down, because Shainman, what are you gonna make noise in the kitchen?
Oh, I'm sorry.
I mean, I can stop, but
no, I'm sorry. I thought I was being quiet. I'll try harder.
Thank you. You have no idea how much even the tiniest sounds are picked up by the microphone. And things that you wouldn't notice, that you would think are just nothing sounds, they just ring out. Okay, back to the story of this thing that may or may not be a sign. If it's a sign, it's a violation of law, and it needs to come down. Because Shainman was denied a permit for this sign, or not sign, whatever it is. Here's Shainman, he says, I naively thought I could just explain it, and they'd agree. And he's got to pay $200 a day for this thing being up. They were saying it's a sign, and it isn't. I don't know. Did he try to get a permit for a sign? But he's also saying that it's not a sign. I guess he thought he could get a permit, but if he can't get a permit, he wants to say, I don't need a permit because it's not a sign within the meaning of the statute. I mean, that makes sense, because you could say, look, they might say it's a sign, and in case they do, I'll try to get a permit. But if they're going to say, no, you can't have the permit, then I'll switch to saying it's not a sign. Well, the alternative would be to just assume it's not a sign, put it up, and then when they come and say it's a sign, at that point try to get the permit. Anyway, they didn't want to give him a permit. They don't like this big message up on the school. He put it up anyway. So he put the sign up anyway and said, "We're good people doing something we're allowed to do." And I said, "I love the good people argument. That's not how freedom of speech works. The good people get extra leeway. In freedom of speech, you have your freedom whether you're good or not, and to give privileges to the good that you deny to the bad, that's viewpoint discrimination. That's exactly what you don't do." Is the argument that they have special rights because it's art or because they're good people? I don't think either of those arguments work well. I don't think it works well to say, well, we're good people, so we should be able to speak, and bad people can't. I don't think that's a good argument, obviously, but I don't th also think it's not a good argument to say, this is art. When we write some words on a building, it's art, but when other people write words on a building, it's not art, so that the freedom to speak without needing a permit, without getting the approval of the government, depends on whether it's regarded as art or not. And the courts are gonna say art or not art. Well, why would art get a special privilege? Isn't what's the basis for that? That's a discrimination too, and it's not something courts are well equipped to do, but it isn't even where the line should be drawn. If people want to say something, they should be able to say it whether they're doing it artistically or not. Like if I just want to speak a sentence, if I made it into a poem, I just had the two parts of my get Trump, pack your shit, you're not legitimate. Now it's a poem, so now it's art, so I can say that's not the basis for why you have freedom of speech, that it's art. But anyway, from the lawyer, it doesn't sound like that was the argument. The lawyer, whose name is William J. Better, he went to the definition of what a sign is in the law. Because notice, the question isn't whether it's a sign or not a sign, it's whether it's covered by the statute. And the statute uses the word sign, but it also says what they mean by a sign. And a sign is defined in the statute as an announcement, direction, or advertisement. And so the lawyer is saying, truth be told, is not an announcement, it's not a direction, and it's not an advertisement. It's not an advertisement, right? It's not a direction, it's not like one way or a dead end. Is it an announcement, truth be told? I mean, if the burden should be on whoever writes the statute, so it should be narrowly construed. I think the best argument there is just that sign, as it's defined in the statute, uses these three concepts, and it's arguable, it's ambiguous whether which side of it is on, and so the government, it should be construed narrowly since it restricts speech. But Better is not making the argument that he's not taking the elitist position and saying the law doesn't apply because it's art. He's talking viewpoint discrimination. Here's an argument he makes. He says if someone puts up season's greetings on their door for Christmas, would the village tell them to take it down? I think not. Right? So it would be viewpoint discrimination if truth be told had to come down, but season's greetings didn't. And yet the truth be told sign is extremely large. Maybe the season's greetings banner over the door wouldn't get the attention of the authorities, but if someone put up season's greetings in a 21 by 160 foot sign, maybe that would be noticed. So, do we think that wouldn't be considered a sign within the meaning of the code because it's a greeting and not an announcement, an advertisement, or a direction? Is a greeting an announcement? Is the imperative truth be told, is that an announcement? We could get very far down the road of talking what an announce. What is it announcing? It's not announcing anything. It's making a demand. It's a demand. A demand is not an announcement. That's what I would say. Anyway, if the distinction were made between whether it was art, I think would we have a distinction between bad art and good art? Because I think if you look at it as art, it doesn't really seem to be very artistically set up. It's the letters are separate vinyl letters, and they go around the corners of the building, and you know, told goes around the edge of the building. So it's actually quite hard to read. They should have made the letters somewhat different height or narrowness so that it would have fit on the building better. I just don't know why they didn't adjust it to the building. Anyway, maybe that's just an art criticism. But if the free speech question depended on whether it was art or not, I would say the sloppiness of the way the letters are put up on the building would be a basis for saying it's not art. It's just basically like graffiti. It's just writing on a wall. It's particularly noticeable that the H at the end of truth is kind of right over the door. And if it were adjusted into a slightly different position, it wouldn't be hanging in front of the door, but the squared out part under the center bar of the H would be right where the door was, and you could walk right in the door quite easily. So why didn't they plan it better? Anyway, that's not an argument about free speech. That's just an art argument and wondering how slapdash a piece of art can really get away with being in a small town when it's that large. It's kind of an imposition on the people. It makes me think about the artist Christo and the projects that he did and how much he worked in getting people who actually lived in the place to accept what he was doing and understand what he was doing. This doesn't seem to have any of that quality of winning the support of the people in the area and of giving to them. It seems more hostile toward them. It's as if it's saying, you know, it's a little bit similar to saying you're a liar to say truth be told. Who's to say the truth isn't already told? And you're sort of dropping into this town to tell them not to be such liars, so they take offense. But of course, if that's why they want the sign down, because they're offended that this guy has the impudence to tell them to tell the truth as if they're not telling the truth, then that sounds more like viewpoint discrimination, and it ought to count in favor of the artist. So the more annoying and cheeky and ungood he really is, the more support I think his free speech argument would have. Oh, and then here's John Bolton on ABC News. And he's saying, I don't have quite the quote. I have an embed here, but he is saying Trump lost the election and the claims of fraud are baseless. You'll have to go to the blog and click on that to hear what he had to say, because I did not write down the text. Of course, Trump responded to Bolton's appearance on ABC News this morning by basically saying once again that he's an idiot, that he's stupid. So it's kind of a schoolboy taunts between the two old men. I'm going to skip over that. All the more reason. I'm just going to talk about one more thing, and this is about Kamala Harris. I'm reading, Harris's allies wonder anxiously, will she have real clout, by Chelsea Janes and Sean Sullivan in the Washington Post. I mean, there's all this excitement about Kamala Harris getting the vice presidency, but it's just the vice presidency. It's a famously nothing position. So once you're in it, you look around and you got to wonder, what have I got? What have I got here? Well, you do get to live in the vice president's mansion, which I've heard is very nice. But what are you really doing? You're sort of parked over there on the side. She might be upgraded to the president position, but if that doesn't happen or until that happens, what is she really going to be doing? Of course, Joe Biden knows all about that, having been vice president. So from the article in the Washington Post, let me just read you about a paragraph. But while black activists remain excited about Harris's ascent, many now worry that the administration will not deliver much beyond her historic election, a fear sharpened by Democrats' disappointing performance in congressional races, which has dramatically limited Biden's maneuvering room. Their worries are underlined by the ongoing uncertainty over whether over what exactly Harris's portfolio will be in the Biden administration and how much freedom she will have to chart her own course on issues like racial justice and immigration. Biden has not announced a portfolio for Harris the way Biden handled the economic stimulus for Obama, and Harris's allies are watching anxiously to see if she will be allowed to choose her top staffers or if Biden loyalists will be installed. But the prospect of Harris carving out her own identity within the administration would be a departure from the traditional role of the vice president as a low-profile servant of the president, one without a separate agenda. As Biden was contemplating whom to choose as his running mate earlier this year, his inner circle was split over Harris. Some worried she would seize any opportunity to advance her own career, citing her attack on Biden's record on race during the Democratic primary. I mean, there's some, close quote, so there's some talk of whether she would be given an explicitly racial portfolio to deal with. But if she were to do that, she might be more off on her own, burnishing her own career. I mean, we know how she treated Biden in that first debate when she used race to really, really tear him down and make a big splash that then ended up going nowhere for her. So will they give her the race issue within the administration, or will they give her something else? Will they give her something that has to do with her experience as the Attorney General of the state of California? That might not, that could be worked out. Maybe that could be put together. Anyway, there's this excitement about having the first woman vice president, the first woman elected to a position in the executive branch of the government. But what will come of it? Will she simply be hidden away? Anyway, well, it started to get dark as I was giving this little podcast, throwing this little podcast together. The trees are still blowing all over the place, but it's darkening quickly. So it's Sunday night, and I guess I'll just close the old podcast down, and I'll see you tomorrow.